Okay, comrades, this is welcome to the discussion, latest discussion meeting of organised by Consistent Democrats. And this week we will have Paul, who will be speaking on centrism. I think it's before, what was the title of it? Between Reform and Revolution, or something like that. So I'll hand you over to Paul. Thank you, comrades.
Afternoon, comrades. I'm doing a talk based on Kotke's 1934 essay on centrism. Obviously, we don't quite mean centrism in the way that we talk about centrism in the way that we do today, like neoliberalism, New Labour, that sort of thing. We're talking about a kind of Kotkeism within revolutionary movements during the time of Kotke, where at a certain point during revolutionary movements, there becomes a crossroad whereby which, if I may put it bluntly, it's almost like certain elements of the Kotkeist movement sort of get the shits, and it's like they abandon their kind of revolutionary fervour. But at the same time, they also denounce other forms of centrism. So, so for instance, Kotke talks about the a classic example would be bureaucratic centrism, where the Soviet Union regime under Stalin would have been a classic example of that, where they still use the language of revolutionary, and they have certain elements of revolutionary policies within their program, but then sort of stop short of what's really needed. And this kind of thing went on an international arena in Austria, Germany, and France. I can't necessarily remember the names of some of the organisations. The ILP was one of them. Obviously, that happened in Britain. On the one hand, they still believe in revolutionary politics, but as events sort of unfold, it's like they don't really know where to go after that. And it's like they end up embracing some form of social democracy while pretending that they're still revolutionaries, if that makes sense. But at the same time, they denounce centrism, that happened also in parts of Holland, but what Kotke said at the end of all of this was that one of the prescriptions for it is to not to sort of cower away, but to acknowledge what's actually happening, and to not dismiss those out of hand that are in fact central, because if we listen to their concerns, it's possible that they could actually be won over. Just as events unfold, they kind of flirt with the elements of centrism. I'm awfully sorry, but I've forgotten some of the examples that I've taken note of, and maybe I'll have to do it some other time, do a better one. I'll have to stop there. Sorry about that.
Okay, Marie wants to speak, I think.
No, I just gave my son.
Oh, right. Well, shall I come in and just say a few words about this? Yeah. Because I think this is a very complex subject. It's not easy to understand. But what it's really, I mean, it's not a matter of some Trotskyist groups versus other Trotskyist groups either. I mean, this is not a phenomenon within Trotskyism. It's something more general that it can involve Trotskyist groups or people with a formal commitment to Trotskyism. But it can involve, I would argue that some elements of the Second International before the First World War were in reality centrist, you know. they made all the right noises about the need for revolution, but they capitulate when push comes to shove and they adopt reformist policies, you know. That was probably true of most of the International before the decisive capitulation in 1914, actually. You know, that most of the International, apart from the Russian Bolshevik section, actually did capitulate. You know, very small minorities of other parties, like the Germans and the Poles and the French and even the British, did not capitulate, you know, and actually maintained an internationalist opposition to the war. Those people came together later to form the Communist International, or at least a lot of them did, you know, and that was a genuinely revolutionary current that was formed, that was tested in action by the First World War and by the need to oppose it in a revolutionary manner. But I mean, there were people in the First World War, during the First World War, who were centrist, who made some elements of pacifist or proclaimed their opposition to the war in some ways, in theory, but in practice they went along with the mainstream. I'm thinking about people like Karl Kautsky, who formally opposed the First World War, but he preached unity with the people who the social imperialists who actually sent the workers into the trenches to fight each other, you know. So unity with the Scheidemanns and the Noschkas and the leaders of the German social democracy was preached by Karl Kautsky, which is why Lenin was extremely savage in attacking Kautsky, because what he was attacking was centrism, was hypocrisy, right? If you read Lenin's pamphlet, The Proletarian Revolution and the Renegade Kautsky, it's very sharp, and it really does attack Kautsky. It attacks him for being a hypocrite more than anything else. That's probably the most used polemical phrase in that pamphlet. Because what he's attacking is someone who uses words, who opposes the war in words, but in practice sides with the people who are waging the war against the far left, against Lenin, against the proto-communist international, against the genuine internationalists. That is probably the first example, you could argue, of centrism. All the subsequent examples, I mean, it's possibly not the best way to introduce the topic, is thinking about it, is to give to look at Trotsky's writings in the 1930s against the ILP, or the London Bureau of Revolutionary Socialist Parties, which wasn't really revolutionary, or the various fragments of centrism that existed then. Because there was a much bigger example earlier, which was Karl Kautsky, you know. But that's the idea, that people will take a halfway house between revolution, halfway house position between revolution and reform, and attempt to straddle the difference, and attempt to blur over the contradiction between them. That's what centrism is. And you find that centrists can have they have an arrow attached to them as to which way they're going. Some centrists are moving to the left, some centrists are moving to the right. You know. I mean, I think of Jerry Downing at one point. Jerry Downing was once my closest comrade, and he broke from us, and he's, you know, you can see him moving to the right, you know, and embracing aspects of softness on Zionism, and he stayed with the Labour Party. He was vehement against anybody who wouldn't vote for Keir Starmer in the last general election. And, of course, he put himself to the right of most of the ex-Corbyn people, who are actually most of them are left reformists, but couldn't stomach voting for Keir Starmer. But because of his particular interpretation of Trotskyism, he ended up voting for Keir Starmer and advocate and denouncing people who wouldn't vote for Keir Starmer, and coming from effectively attacking the most honest left-wing reformists from the right. You know, that's an example of centrism, in my opinion. You know, there are many other examples, though. You know, Paul wants to speak. I'll let him come back. Sorry, I'm rambling on too much.
At the beginning, when you said that it wasn't just Trotskyist, that was actually my error, being a bit too puritanical, because it was Trotsky's essay I was taking it from, so, and I thought that he was mostly talking about Trotskyist groups. That's where that came from. So that was an error on my part. I just wanted to clarify that. That was all. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Sure. But that is what, yeah, that is the real, sorry, I think Marie wants to speak anyway now. I'll let Marie speak, yeah?
I don't have much original to say. Paul, you were not wrong. It was not an error to look in the Trotskyist aspect of this question. I think it was very brave of you to take on this introduction. It was quite... an intricate problem, so I hope you don't feel that you have made an error, but that you have seen something a little bit differently now, and that you can do another attempt another time. I'm going to just look at this thing from the point of view of the Bolsheviks, so that, for example, today the program of Lenin, the program of the Bolshevik Revolution, is still necessary. It is still valid, and to organize the party around the program, the Bolshevik program, is still correct. Of course, then if you do that, you can find people who find you a sectarian. And then there is a whole struggle, you know, for you to explain that, no, you are not against the transitional demands which people make as they find themselves in struggle. So it's not wrong today, for example, to go along with the, it seems to me, the program of Miliband for the production of clean energy, as said, you know, clean energy as they call it, and to stop using gas and oil. It's not a subject upon which one would say that we must continue to use gas and oil. It is an opportunity to explain there are other forms of energy, and therefore one can diversify and progress in that way. The only problem there is that the Labour government is intending to use that energy for the production of weapons, for the cheap production of weapons, and for the rearmament of Britain. And there, there obviously... one oneself as a Bolshevik with a Bolshevik program or Bolshevik intention, one goes back then to this question to show that this transformation, which could have been progressive, is regressive in the hands of the Labour government. And so there is the need to demonstrate that no, we are not sectarian, but at the same time, we do not go along with everything which seems to be progressive. We look at things in their movement. Mm-hmm. I think with the consistent Democrats, they are trying to show the need to create a honest party, a party which is actually going to bring transformation and revolutionary change. And in between there, you will have people who find that the program is too old for optimistic, you know, for the future, that we are not yet at that stage. But if we do not put forward the program of the need to nationalize and to plan the economy, if we do not do that, then the doors get open of the party to people who just want to enter in order to produce a centrist solution. And I can see, for example, Farage is talking about all the people who enter illegally, in boats particularly, they enter Britain illegally, so they are criminals to start with because they have entered illegally. They should be expelled immediately and there should be no procedures. And I see that Blunkett and Straw, Jack Straw in the Labour Party, are moving towards this position, which is what Ian was explaining, you know, how you see people moving to the right, and you can see that in the Labour Party, particularly all this movement, internal movement, and then the people who want to build a new party, like Sultana and Corbyn. So they themselves are going to find themselves, you know, we can foresee for them and we can contribute to them. I propose that that be our intention, to contribute to them for them to do the best job they can, to go as far as they can, and to stick particularly to the good points of program which they have. And so that means for them to revise, to review the Corbyn experience, what went wrong with the Corbyn experience, which is full of teachings if we use this method of looking between reform and revolution. And then finally, yeah, I would like to say the changes which are happening in the Labour Party do not happen because somebody or other in the Labour Party has a good idea, but because there's a trade unions underneath. And I see that Unite is in dispute with the bin workers dispute. Unite is in a dispute which requires sticking to the guns of the defense of the working class. Mm. And this creates in the Labour Party currents which become critical of the council in Birmingham, or Exham, I think this is the other place, and the demand from sectors of the trade unions that Labour should support. They should support this fight for the bin workers. And the interesting thing is that we are in a stage of history when this matter has now spread to the population. So when I went to a meeting of a trade union meeting, a trade council meeting, there was Deepak there and there were the bin workers and the trade councils. And so you could see and some labor people who I had not noted in the past. So there is a reshuffle, constant reshuffle, which in fact is demanded by the fact the working class doesn't give up. The working class is that class which doesn't abandon because it cannot. It's got the whole of history. It hasn't got a 4 years term. It is going to continue and continue and continue to make demands. And in front of this, if you want, there is the need to answer what the working class poses, which is we need another society. It's not going to have its rights, the working class, and the colonized world will not have their rights until we have finished with the capitalist system. And so the Bolshevik program, which is, I believe, defended by consistent Democrat, is a point of, it's not to be implemented next week or tomorrow, but it's got to be defended in order to give consciousness to people that the system just simply cannot be reformed. The system is not going to accept giving to the colonies their emancipation and giving to labor power its rights to control what it produces. This is not going to happen. And so it seems to me this discussion is particularly important to give confidence to us that even though we don't see tremendous changes from day to day, we are building, or we should be building, the organization which is not going to give up, and which is going to tell the truth to the workers. Now, Farage says that he says things as they are, but he doesn't, because he doesn't mention that the reason why people come here in boats is because they have been thrown out from their countries by the capitalist system and by imperialism, and know that they cannot survive where they are, and so they come where there's jobs or seemingly possibility of getting support. And so they come to France, and they come to Italy, they come to Greece, to Turkey, and to Britain. Britain is not the only country, and in fact it is the country that receives the fewest immigrants. So the Farage is not telling the workers the way it is. The truth of the matter is capitalism has made 82 wars or counter-revolutions from the last war to today, and people are expelled by the crisis in their countries, which has been provoked by the West, and particularly the French, the British, and the Americans in particular, but not exclusively. And so people move around in order to desperately look for a way to live. And this is a desperate situation. And this is why it is desperately necessary that we should give all our attention to the building of this organization and to the consistent Democrats and those who do like the consistent Democrats, tell the truth and keep the program, which is going to change things. And also to give orientation to this new party of, they call it Your Party, they want to change its name. We should contribute to the changing of the name and possibly to say to them that they must have the program of confronting NATO. Understanding Ukraine, revising what happened with Corbyn, and to derive the name from this perspective, that there is a need of the transformation and of the construction of an international organization of the working class. And so for that, they must look not just to Britain, but to the working class of Europe and that of the United States, who are creating a lot of problems for the capitalists. Continuously, like they did over Vietnam, forcing it to back down, and like they over Gaza, for example, that nobody can build an organization which is not taking an interest in the significance of what Gaza means. Once on one side the genocide, and on the other side, the incapacity of Israel to complete its purpose, because it's impossible for imperialism to complete the purpose of liquidating the masses. This is just not going to happen. Right, so that's it. Sorry, I was long-winded.
That's all right. Paul wants to speak, I think.
It's a bit difficult to follow that, because Mari has left me with quite a few points I would like to follow up on, which I'm quite pleased about, but it's kind of how much I remember.
Yeah, sure.
But before I go on to that, though, going back to the Kochi piece, in my defence, Kochi himself, in the essay that I was taking back from, did actually say that the problem with syncretism, in the sense that he was talking about, is that the reason he did say himself it was difficult to define,
mm-hmm.
because there wasn't a definition in the way that he would describe it. He himself said that syncretism is largely defined by what it lacks. In other words, it lacks revolutionary fervour. And it gets so far, and then it's like, oh, now what do we do? We don't want to do this, because we're not sure of the consequences if we do go ahead with this. So it's like they start to worry about what the outcome might be, and that the outcome might not be what they'd intended. That's the way I interpret that statement anyway. Perhaps it's a wildly optimistic interpretation of what he said in that paragraph, but that's why I find it quite difficult to define. But now, to the point that Marie have made, quite an interesting one, because and we've talked about immigration and so on, but the interesting point is that even within the Labour movement, not the Labour Party, this is different, the Labour movement is actually quite divided on the whole question of immigration. And I know one organisation, the Workers' Party, unfortunately takes the same line on immigration that UKIP and Reform now takes. But what they need to understand about immigration, and a lot of the working class movement need to understand that about immigration, is that, yes, when you bring in immigration, you have to have resort for them when they arrive and so on. But at the same time, those very people are going to be the people that provide the resources that we all need. They're going to be our doctors, our refuse collectors, etc., etc. So this idea that somehow immigrants are separate to the rest of the working class, of the people that live in the country they come to, I really take issue with. They're not separate. They're part and parcel of the Labour movement that everyone else is part of. So I just wanted to get that on my chest, and I thank Marie for bringing the point out that she made about immigration. Now, this is what's really interesting, because I hope Marie doesn't mind me mentioning, but me and Marie and a few other comrades over the months and the last few years have been talking about whether the Labour movement could split from the Labour Party, stay with the Labour Party, and then so on and so forth. I make no secret that my own view on this matter is different to Marie's view on the matter. Mm-hmm. I personally take the view that the Labour Party is done for, and a new party needs to be created. I think Marie would like that as well, but it's the question of how you get there that we differ on, I suspect. However, Marie would have said to some of us in the past, and this is why it's interesting, because she said, we cannot leave the Labour Party because that's where the working class are, that's where the trade unions are, and so on. But my point is that a lot of the working class in Britain, at least, today, is not unionised, let alone affiliated with the Labour Party. That's one aspect of it. But on the other hand, we've had this discussion within the Conservative Democrats as well. We are now finding that despite everything Keir Starmer and his entourage have done with the Labour Party, kicked out people, had them arrested and so on and so forth, we are now finding that forces within the Labour Party nevertheless are fighting back, despite everything thrown at it. So it just shows events can take a funny turn now and again, doesn't it? So I hope you're pleased, Murray, that I've at least acknowledged those points within the contradictions about whether to stay involved in the Labour Party or to go elsewhere. And I'm now beginning to realise that it's not quite as clear-cut as some of us would like to think it is. It's actually becoming incredibly complicated. I for one, Murray mentioned your party, or what currently called your party. There will be a name change, I'm sure. I think many of us here have signed up to your party. It's essentially a mailing list at the moment, and there are events for your party going on around the country. I think they're mostly hosted by Counter Fire and SWP, but that point aside, I have actually made my own contribution to the name change, my submission to your party for the name change was to call it Movement for a Communist Party, and the explanation I gave for it was to say that we should not be afraid to say that we're communist, and change must come from the working class, and I said a few other things alongside that, but I can't remember what else I said, but I did sign a comment to friends of mine on social media that I know that name change won't be accepted. I'm just trying to push the envelope a little because, to start with, and I think this is where Marie's kind of coming from, maybe you have to start with something really outrageous, and then at least at some point, you will get some of what you want, even if it's not everything. You can, if you start with some very seemingly unrealistic demands, you're more likely to get something that you would want to see as events start to unfold. I'll give you an example. Marie mentioned trade unions. I remember the FBU, they made a pay demand. I think it was something like 35,000 a year or something like that. And everyone thought this was absolutely ridiculous. And I said to a friend of mine, I said, come on. The FBU know they're not going to get that amount of money. But the point is to come out with a demand that you know you're not going to get, but you give yourself a bit of leverage when it comes to negotiations. So we shouldn't be afraid to demand things that we know that at the moment we're not going to get. But You've got to keep pushing and pushing, and eventually you will get some of the things that you want to see in society. I know we're probably going off a bit off topic here, but I just wanted to follow some of my points because I thought they were very good. Thanks.
Susan.
Right, sorry, my hand didn't appear to go up. Okay. One of the things I find quite fascinating is that whereas communism is not illegal in this country, anarchism is specified particularly for the Counter-Terrorism Act. And this is because, and as far as I can see, this is because anarchism is the political view that there should be no ruling class. And it seems to me that it would be more radical for us to be, you know, if we want the working class, it is actually more behoven to us to get rid of the ruling class, the monarchy, and to be against NATO and the projection of power through military organizations, rather than this endless argument between left and right and how it's achieved as a revolutionary power. But it struck me as very strange that anarchists, which is about grassroots, taking, you know, power structures which are taken for the people, the, if you like, the common people, but they are organizations of power structures at the level at which they are going to be felt and organized, are prescribed specifically as anarchist and therefore terrorist, whereas communism, which wishes to replace the ruling class with the working class, are not. So, Paul, I would like to know how that fits into Trotsky's centrism, because clearly anarchy as removal of the working class should fit in with communism, but is not. And has anyone else any ideas as to why the government should specifically say extreme left, anarchist, and single issue causes, which is the LACIT part of the terrorism bill, yeah, or terrorism act, why it should pick out anarchists as being automatically terrorists?
Do you want me to answer that, or do you want? Yeah,
I was going to refer to you as the person who is. Who is giving the speech? How does that fit in with the issue of, you know, because the whole point of centrism and the danger of centrism is that it interferes with the full-on production of a true revolutionary movement or a true revolutionary goals being achieved. Yes?
Mm. To be honest, I'm not sure where anarchism would fit in the central part of it, but at the same time, I also slightly disagree with your interpretation of what anarchism is, because as far as I understand it, anarchism is not the, or maybe this is a bit literal on my part, but it's not the abolition of the ruling class per se, it's the abolition of the state. That's what anarchism is.
Yeah,
and for communists, whether you're Stalinist or Trotskyist, the thing about, well, maybe not for Stalinist, but I think for Leninists and Trotskyist, and even Marx and the Engels have basically said that once the ruling class takes control of society, preferably by international means, and that's what difficulty from Stalin, because Stalin didn't believe in international revolution. He believed in socialism in one country. That really is where Trotsky and Stalin differ big time. The thing is, once you have a revolution in the way that Trotsky, Lenin, Marx, and, you know, some of the others would say, then I believe Engels is actually being quoted as saying that once the working class take control of, you know, resources and so on, enable the roots, as it were, I'm paraphrasing, of course, then the state withers away. I believe Marx said that in the Manifesto of the Communist Party. So if you like, they do actually believe, if you like, the same ideal. It's a question of how you get there, that's the issue. So I think from a Trotskyist or Leninist perspective, anarchism, without that revolutionary change, the change to class that runs society, it's just idealism. It doesn't exist in practice. So you have to fight within the structures that you've got from where you are at that particular point in time. Then it's your class, i.e. the working class, to succeed in taking the reins of that power. Then, gradually, the need for the state should actually just wither away, as Marx says, or Engels says. And so that's my answer. Might not be a very satisfactory one, but that's the way I like to answer that one. I hope that gives a bit of an understanding of where I come from on that matter. Thanks.
Okay, I'll speak there just for a while.
I've put you the definite Oxford English definition of anarchism in the chat, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
But just let me say a few things. I mean, I think anarchism, the real difference between Marxism and anarchism is that anarchism believes you can immediately abolish the state without having any transition away from it. And, some anarchist groups do fit the definition of centrism. Some of them are all over the place, and some of them are just sort of eccentric little groups that don't really do very much. There's the freedom people, there's the class war people, there's the if you look to the Spanish Civil War, there are the Friends of Durruti, who actually fused with the Trotskyist movement in the later stages of the conflict. Unfortunately, the forces they had at their disposal were still too small, really, to make a difference, because a much larger centrist organisation, the PUM, had already marginalised them and capitulated to the Popular Front. But the Friends of Durruti were a revolutionary anarchist group in Spain who merged with the what was called the Communist Left in the later stages of the Civil War. And they actually did fight for a revolutionary programme. They effectively had to abandon anarchism and the idea that you could simply abolish the state just by decree, because you can't. You know, the whole point about Marxists is that our understanding is that the state is a machine that reconciles class contradictions and attempts to hold society together so it doesn't immediately collapse into civil war. And it always does so on behalf of a ruling class, of course. The ruling class has an interest in suppressing class antagonisms and not letting them explode into civil war. And when the ruling class is the working class, it will also have an interest in holding down class-based opposition. We do not want the bourgeoisie to overthrow the workers' state and restore capitalism. So we pull what we have and we organise to stop that. The anarchists don't believe that that's an issue. And that's the problem. They think it's just pure spontaneity is all you need, you know. Whereas what you actually need is organisation. And the state will wither away when the material basis for class divisions withers away. You know, that's the point. Is it the material basis of crime? You know, it could happen quite quickly today because you can see the material base for communism and for developed planning of the world economy. Would be actually relatively easy compared to what it was in the past because of developments like computer technology, artificial intelligence, and a whole range of things that were not available in the days of Lenin and Trotsky, would make planning a relatively painless thing compared to, well, certainly painless compared to the economic convulsions that are being caused by capitalism today, you know. And there's no reason why a lot of the inventions of modern capitalism cannot be repurposed in a very on a very high level to plan the world economy, and I think that would lead to the withering of the state because it would no longer be necessary to repress whole sections of humanity who are at odds with the established order, which is what we're dealing with today, you know. But yeah, you can't just abolish the state, because if you do, you know, every social force on the, you know, with its antagonistic interests would simply fight each other, you know, in an unrestricted manner. The working class has an interest in stopping the capitalists from taking power, from retaking power once it seizes power. But to a certain point, you can, you know, this problem becomes economically liquidated because actually you've got a more productive economy than capitalism. And you can see aspects of that about China and places like that, which are so fantastically productive, they're outpacing US imperialism and things like AI, you know. That just shows what's possible, I think, you know. High technology is the Russians are ahead of the even in terms of military high tech. Russia is ahead, even though Russia isn't strictly socialist. It has an element of economic planning still in its economy, and it's outdistanced the United States in terms of high stuff, high level stuff like hypersonic missiles and things like this. You know, they're on a higher technological level than the best of capitalism today. You know, I think that's because, you know, even though Russia took a huge step backwards, there are still elements of that higher mode of production is making an impact in their economic situation to this day, and it is a higher mode of production, and therefore you've seen this technological overtaking by worker states and sort of halfway ex-worker states and things like this, you know. It's very difficult. I mean, just going on to the question of the Labour Party, though, I think the Labour Party has been broken, and it's, you know, I think the trade unions will split from the Labour Party, because I think this new party, this thing is bigger than the Labour Party. It's much bigger in terms of its mass following than the Labour Party. And that's not just, you know, Corbyn's leadership proved that in two general elections, both of which it lost, but he got more, considerably more votes than Starmer did in the last one when he won, and he only won because the Tories collapsed, you know. And now the mass base of Corbynism has gone over to a new party. And if it, you know, it might not be formally up and running yet. It takes time. I don't think it will be properly up and running until sort of like next spring. I think even a conference in November or December or whenever will decide some things. But the thing won't really get going until people get stuck into some election campaigns or whatever. You know, I think that will happen next year, you know. And it will have to organise, but the mass base is already there. It's likely to get to a million by the time of the conference. And if people know the history of the Labour Party, after the Second World War, the Labour Party had a million members. You know, now it's got 300,000 and falling. You know, it had 500,000 under Corbyn. You know. But it lost 200,000 in the last few years because of the attack on the Corbyn movement by Starmer. And the unions, well, the unions today are a shadow of what they were. You know, this is the thing. I mean, there are a lot of unions who are very, very, what's the word? The blue collar unions have been hammered, right? Particularly the miners' union, the steel workers, because of deindustrialization. You've got unions that are relatively organized management of middle and higher, you know, elements of the middle class, and have a very petty bourgeois outlook. And I think there'll be a splintering of the unions away from the Labour Party. Some may well stay with the rump of the Labour Party, only if it shows it's viable, because it may just collapse, you know. But I think there already is a mass-based Corbynite party being formed. And it's just obvious, really. I mean, these things are happening. I went to a meeting in Croydon last week. 150 people turned up. You know, that's a pretty big meeting for a founding meeting, you know, in an outer London borough. I suspect there is a meeting this Friday of your party in South London, in Brixton, being addressed by Zara Sultana. And I'm intending to go along to that. You know, that'd be a big event, I think, you know. There's a lot going on, and it's really taking off, actually, as a movement, I think. It will be a mass party. It already is a mass party, except it hasn't got the formal level of organisation yet. And it's going to be messy, you know. It doesn't have a bureaucracy. It may not ever have a bureaucracy. Hopefully it won't, you know. And, you know, centrism, you know, I mean, the subject of this thing is centrism. I think centrism is a very likely development because this is not a hardened social democratic organisation. This is in flux. And there are people who are formerly left reformists who are sympathetic to aspects of Marxism. And there's a huge potential for an echo and for popularizing some basic Marxist concepts in its ranks, you know. And that's why I think we should be optimistic. And it will also, draw it small, relatively large, but in party terms, relatively small sects like the SWP, the Socialist Party, will be drawn into this, and they are being drawn into it, and they will find their sectarianism being broken down by this process. And I think that is very progressive. You know, they couldn't do it. The Labour Party could not accommodate these people, but this formation can. It can draw the sting of sectarianism, and this is where centrism becomes a danger, because you'll get spontaneous centrism. You'll get people who've got part of a Marxist worldview, but also part of a reformist view, mixed in together. And our job is partly to educate people to actually separate those things, you know, to clarify in people's minds what is necessary. And that's going to take time, you know. Anyway, the whole point about centrism is centrism in a revolutionary situation can be very dangerous, you know, because it can lead to an organisation that the working class has confidence in, that looks like it could lead a revolution, doing something unpredictable and dangerous, you know, like joining a popular front in the middle of a revolution. And the whole point of the popular front is to put a roadblock in the way of the revolution. You know, and that's what happened in Spain. That's what Le Pen did. You know, it joined the Popular Front, and the whole point of the Popular Front was to derail the revolution. You know, they were naive, and they screwed it up. And that's the danger of centrism, really, to put it bluntly. I'll leave it there. Sorry, Diana wants to speak.
Not sure if I'm being a bit off topic. I would say fundamental to having a party that serves everybody's needs, whether it, you know, communist party, socialism and communism, is that we need to reclaim common ownership of land, and that seems to me a big practical challenge,
That means all sort of rural land, corporately owned farmland, land owned by the sodding royalty and aristocracy, and also the land in cities, the buildings in cities that are just, you know, this luxury trash built for people, sometimes foreigners, sometimes they may be wealthy people here. Like Zelensky, I think he's got some mansions here, hasn't he? They keep a lot of them. They just keep that stuff for making, you know, for financial reasons. But we need the land, and we need it to be self-sufficient in food, to develop a proper food production system, and to restore our ecosystems, which are in a very bad way and which are getting progressively worse with current government's policies.
Oh.
Yeah, obviously I agree with Dan of Uncommon Land. You won't be surprised to hear that, because, you know, obviously in the short term, I favour land value taxation, but in the longer term, I think there should be state ownership of land, which is actually different to common ownership of land, but I certainly think common ownership of land should certainly be a very long term aim. Once it's been acquired by the state, but the reason I wanted to come back in with this whole question about the state withering away once the working class got controlled, and then you could have forms of anarchism, but it suddenly occurred to me that, I don't know about suddenly, but even what the state has withered away, and you could start to form anarchist societies, and there is no state, so to speak. Let's say that happens. At the same time, there's always going to be a potential for counter-revolutions. So even once the state has withered away and anarchists have actually formed their own societies, whether it's one big society or a collection of different societies, each with their own rules, because they do, even anarchist societies have rules. It's a misconception to say that they don't believe in rules, because that's nonsense. But even within that, there's always the potential for a counter-revolution. So even if you do have anarchist societies, once the state is withered away, even they are going to find that they are going to have to build defence forces to stop the counter-revolutionary forces, because there are always going to be people that want to claim interest for themselves, land, property, etc., etc. So, that's my take on it. That might be a bit controversial, but at the moment I can't foresee a situation where you won't at least get an attempt for a group to actually fight back and wish to reclaim some of that class benefit that they used to get before under capitalism. So, in that sense, I still see, whilst I appreciate the long-term aims of anarchists, I still think it's idealism, because I still think there will be groups that with the recapture land, property, etc., and so forth. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I'll let John speak first because I think I spoke quite recently. John. You're muted, John.
No, I was very pleased to hear that 150 people turned out at Croydon. That's brilliant news. I just wonder how the state is going to tackle this, because, you know, that's serious. You know, this has never happened in Britain before, really. You know, in this way, and it's going to be a serious thing. Now, on this point of anarchism, I mean, you know, it's very. You've heard of Alistair MacIntyre. Ian would have. You know, he was a Marxist at one point, but later became He went into some other sort, but he remained sort of on the left. And he said, and I think, you know, when we use this, like, Susan's given us a definition of anarchism up there. And he says, look, the important thing is not whether you're a Christian or whether you're a Marxist or whether you're an anarchist. It's what sort of Marxist, what sort of Christian, what sort of anarchist, right? Because there's so many different sorts. I mean, you know, like there's Roman Catholic, there's evangelical, there's, you know, you can go through the lot. So, you know, when we're talking about Marxism and anarchism, and it's, you know, we have to bear in mind that it can vary quite widely what they believe in, what certain Marxists believe in, and what certain anarchists and certain Christians believe in. And that does vary quite markedly. The thing is, and an interesting tale, just in a way emphasizing that point, I remember it was probably in the early 90s. I had a friend who was a Marxist, and he was doing his PhD on the state. And I was talking to a couple of long-term SWP friends about the state and that, and about various political things. And I told my friend this, and he said, look, John, these SWP people you're talking to, they're not coming out with Marxist ideas. These are anarchist ideas. and so, you know, the line is often blurred, you know. I mean, you know, and when I thought about it, I thought, well, actually, these can be seen as anarchist ideas, you know, because just because you're in a Marxist organization doesn't mean that's what the whole debate about centrism is. You know, just because you're in a Marxist organization doesn't mean you're revolutionary. And just because you're in a Marxist organization doesn't mean you can't have anarchistic ideas, which these people had. And so, you know, anyway, I'll leave it there.
Just on the withering away of the state again, anarchism, I think the difference is that you would, you know, in the immediate aftermath of a revolution, you would need this is sort of repeating what we said before in a way, but putting it in a slightly different way, is that you would need a repressive force to fend off counter-revolution, because the material base for counter-revolution would not have been liquidated at that stage. And the only thing that can liquidate it is further economic and political and social development to do away with the social forces who would want to overthrow the worker state or overthrow the anarchist communes or whatever you call them, you know. And that is the difference, really, in essence, is that they think, anarchists think, that you could have a revolution and forget about the need for an army, or forget about the need for repressive forces to defend that revolution against its opponents. Now, we share the same aim as anarchists. You know, in some ways they are the same ultimate aims, but the problem is that they are not materialists. They do not take account of material reality in understanding how the state is to be abolished. The state can only be abolished when the social need for a state in some form itself withers away, right? And it only withers away when the socially antagonistic forces that would have a class struggle between them themselves wither away. So you have, when you have a classless society and it develops economically to the point that it is actually classless, you don't need a special apparatus anymore to suppress an enemy class. But as long as you do have an enemy class, you need to keep it at bay. You need to have something to keep it, to stop it from overthrowing the rule of the population or the people or the proletariat, whatever you call them. You know, and that's the difference. Only social and economic development that does away with the economic basis of classes can actually cause the state to wither away. If it doesn't, then your state will be, if you attempt to get by without a state, your state will be overthrown by an enemy. And that's what will happen to anarchism. If anarchism ever, by some fluke, took power, it would be overthrown by an enemy, because that enemy would not have withered away. That enemy would still exist. And it would have forsworn in advance the creation of a state machine to defend itself. And therefore, it would just be overthrown. And that's the difference between Marxism and anarchism, in my view. Sorry, I'll leave it there. Susan?
Well, I would say that the current... I see a lot of... I won't call it squealing, but a lot of concern by certain people who are complaining about the lack of direction from the top. And it seems to me that the one of the reasons why your party is gaining as many people to it as at the moment is that it is a grassroots. It has bypassed, if you like, the class definition. And it's interesting that there are people who are complaining about they want it to be more than the working class, or that they don't recognise that they belong to the working class because they work instead of relying on daddy's trust fund. It is the appeal of an organisation which is dependent upon consensus and mutual agreement. And that does not mean that they will not fight to defend their state organization or whatever it is that they have congregated into. But what it does mean is that they do not want an entrenched ruling class. And centrism is the enemy of both, but it is also the undermining of the communist ideal, if you like, of having the working class, because people who have to work for a living do not embrace the hard work that is governance and self-governance. And it requires that, you know, this is what it seems to me Trotsky was really complaining about, was that it was the workers who were not prepared to be part and parcel of the Soviets that would debate and achieve consensus and actually be part of their own self-governance, but preferred to leave it in the hands of a bureaucracy which always seeks to control what is going on. Okay? So what I'm saying is, your party has the potential to do either, And it's not clear with the technology that is coming that consensus and mutual agreement would be beyond us because of both the internet and communication and because of AI and its potential, along with robotics and the ability of the working or the workers of the world to produce and satisfy our needs, if we could remove the profit motive of the capitalists who at the moment hold the financial levers that allow workers to produce efficiently and economically.
Oh.
I think if Lenin or Kropsky were alive today, I think for their response to some of what Susan was saying about, had just said about some of the working class, some of the working class who don't actually align with the working class in terms of political activity, would say that they lack class consciousness. And so there's a bit of political education on the job that's required in that respect. And I do think your party is going to be some good political education, because I know from an Oxford WhatsApp group I'm in that a lot of people that have come into your party really don't seem that radical in many respects. They're pissed off with the Labour Party and other things that are going on, and they're interested in single-issue campaigns, but they're not really interested in class politics, it would seem to me. They're more interested in things like trans rights. I could say for the record, I'm also very pro-LGBT and trans rights, but I get the impression that some of these issues, for some of these people, are very much single-issue campaigns. So I'm slightly concerned about that part of it. If anything, what Susan's actually warning us about is in fact the very idea of centrism. There's clearly going to be a lot of centrism involved in your party as it currently is. What the vehicle will end up becoming is another matter, because it should be remembered, of course, that these battles are yet to be ironed out, because although hundreds of us have signed up to your party as it currently is, there isn't a membership structure. Local organisations haven't been formed itself. There have been local meetings, but they've still got to be formulated, and people have got to take roles and so on and so forth. A name has got to be decided upon. And eventually we're going to have to elect people to positions and to come up with a programme. All that is yet to be ironed out. But the way, when Susan said that some people don't acknowledge their class role in society, that shows to me that there is a serious danger of centripetism within your party as it currently called. And I go back to my point that I do believe Marx, Engels, and Lenin and Kropsky would have all argued, and even Stalin would have argued when it suited him, that they all lacked class consciousness. And I really do believe that. Some people have a bit in their body about considering themselves working class, as if it's some sort of dirty crime, you know. So I do think we're all in for a bit of political education along the way. Thanks.
So, Marie.
Yes, hello. Seems to me that
we have come to discuss this quite well. So there remains aspects which I would like to raise now. It's true that the people who are involved with your party, I don't think this is a revolutionary organization, and I don't think that the people who come with all their passion to take part in it are revolutionaries. But we're dealing with a process. And look how quickly we became suspects and then we became terrorists for defending Palestine action. So it takes only a little bit of gall from the capitalist system to actually turn us into criminals. And this is what they are trying to do. Through the Palestinian thing, we are being criminalized. And so very soon and quickly, one can find oneself in a very radical situation without having planned to take power, for example. And so it seems to me when we, the interesting thing which what I read in Trotsky about this matter, he says it's not a matter of going every minute of the day presenting the program of the Bolshevik Revolution. One has to intervene in the struggle such as it developed, meeting people such as they are, and raising, I think Paul was mentioning, raising the level of consciousness. And so the question of the program, which can be very radical when you talk about the nationalization of the land, it's already not all that, you know, there is already quite an understanding of people in Britain that less than 1% of the population owns all the land is an outrage and it's, you know, doesn't stand to any inspection. And the nationalization of the land is a perfectly rational and moderate demand when you consider the situation we are in. So what is interesting is that the parties of Ian, the party of that he represents, is, it seems to me, an instrument, a tool to intervene in other parties, such as this new party, your party as a new organization. It needs somebody, some people who go in there presenting these ideas. Otherwise, they are going to remain with their labor traditions and their way of doing things, going through the councils and getting selected and elections, all these things which are not based on politics, but which are based on suiting the capitalist councils. And so all this is going to require a tremendous transformation, and it is perfectly right for us to put forward the nationalization of the utilities, the nationalization of the land, etc. When it comes to play, to things like Ireland, one has the duty to pose the need for the withdrawal of the troops, because there are still British troops there. Nobody talks about it. And letting Ireland, North and South, to sort themselves out. What is Britain doing there? And you will find that as you raise these issues, and then you come to the question of Ukraine, and then you defend North Korea, and you say North Korea was quite right, and and to support Russia, then you are very quickly into a very serious confrontation with the capitalist system. And so all this needs tactics, the use of intelligence, not throwing ourselves into the mouth of the lion, and at the same time finding resting on the struggles which take place, like for example the bin workers now I have mentioned, but there is many other struggles just now, and very very little attention is being paid to them. Yet they are the ferment and they are the basis upon which the working class can advance to towards power. So we're not going to have a change of society without the working class advancing. So it seems to me to tie all this up in centrism is something which happens when there is doubt and hesitation. And the role of this organization is to give confidence and to show that the truth is not that the workers are backward. The truth is that the workers have got to make do in a situation when they don't have the right to speak and the right to express themselves. And Parliament is zero compared with the need of the working class to express itself.
Really shortly.
I'm going to finish now.
No, that was someone interrupting me. Don't worry about it.
You were talking to somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think I would like to say to comrades to expect that big changes are coming, and big changes are going to demand big bravery from our part, at the same time as the ability to be tactical and not to just be putting ourselves in jeopardy uselessly. And so I look forward to this being discussed again. Yeah, thank you.
Paul, and then when Paul has spoken, I suggest we think about winding this up because it's getting a bit late and I've got things I've got to do. But Paul.
This isn't greatly on the topic of tranquilism, but as I was following Marika's there, and Marika said big change is coming, and I just happened to remember that I was watching a video on Dialogue Works with Richard Wolff and Michael Hudson, both economists, of course, who were saying that in France, there's going to be a key protest. Is it on the 7th of September? And they threatened to bring Paris down, I believe. And those two pointed out I think it was Professor Richard Wolff, who pointed out that when France tried to lower the height, increase the retirement age. It was over the weapons that are going to be sent for the Ukraine war, and apparently Trump has now forced the Europeans to pay for it. And then Richard Wolff, Michael Hudson made the point that is going to have to be paid for by cutting social welfare and increasing in taxes and so on and so forth. But pointed out that the last time Grant tried to do that by raising the retirement age, Macron was forced to stop it because the working class brought Paris to a standstill. And it does now seem that in September, Paris is going to do a similar thing. And so Marie, I think Marie's right. There are going to be big changes coming one way or another. And I could be keeping my eye very closely what's going on in France in September as best I possibly can, because that could be a catalyst for what takes place elsewhere in Europe, if not other parts of the world. So I just wanted to add that in there as a note of optimism, as I make, because I think things are going to become very interesting. Thanks.
Okay, comrades, can we think about winding this up? I suggest, though, that we have a meeting in 2 weeks' time to discuss your party and the state of play in the formation, because I think it's a very, very big subject now. There's a lot going on. If you watch Crispin Flintoff's show in the morning, you get a sense of it. I watched it this morning, though I'm a bit tied up with other things as well. But there's a lot going on. There really is a lot going on. We need to draw some sort of what's the word, some sort of perspective, and not a balance sheet, because it's nothing like finished, it's not a finished product, but some sort of a coherent discussion about an understanding about where we're going with this, because I think it is very important. I think I have a great deal of hope in this. I think it will actually consolidate into something quite dramatic, and I think the British ruling class is going to find it very threatening indeed, actually.
There's also a slightly shorter programme with on a Thursday evening very often. Again, if we're really interested in your party, this is at the ground level. It's showing you meetings and the talking points, which if we're hoping to to bring points to the table for people to discuss and maybe support, then obviously knowing what they're talking about and how it goes down is really helpful to us.
Yeah. Anyway, so I suggest we have a discussion on your party and I'll publish. Yeah. I didn't do a very good job in publicising this, but I've been a bit overloaded with work. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that will come to that will be moderated. Yeah. We'll do a better job on this one, and we'll try and have a forum on your party and see what we get. Yeah.
And I will have the Christian Zionism ready for when you want it, because again, it will be an incredibly important topic.
I was
horrified this morning to see somebody saying, oh, well, Zionism should be left for the Jewish community to decide. And I'm going, but more people are Christian Zionists than Jewish Zionists. You know, how can you leave it? You know, this is exactly what the Zionists want, for us to be sidelined, to have no voice and no opinion.
Mm.
Yeah. So we, you know, the education we've got to do is at so many levels and on so many sides.
Interesting.
Especially the geopolitics. Anyway, thank you again, everybody.
Again in 2 weeks, yeah?
Yep.
Is that right, comrades?
Yeah, and thank you again, Paul. I'm sure it was a really tough, because it's so broad, where to start. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Cheers.
Thank you, Paul.
I'll try and do a better one next time I do one.
Okay, that's great. Anyway, it was a good start. Yeah. Let's wind up now. Yeah. See you, comrades. See you soon. Yeah. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.